Okay, so let's go on with the sutta. Bhikkhus, this is the Buddha speaking still. Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, was also subject to these things. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to these things, do I seek what is also subject to these things? Suppose that, being myself subject to these things, having understood the danger in them, I seek the unborn, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless, the sorrowless, the undefiled, supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So what the Buddha is doing here, instead of, he's talked about these two searches, these two quests, the noble and ignoble quest. And what he's doing is going to tell his life story as the embodiment, the example of what it is to live the noble quest. One interesting way of teaching. I think it must be a sort of special kind of occasion for him. He's obviously, I think he's felt very touched by these bhikkhus, and I think it's the only place where he talks about the noble and ignoble quest, as far as I know, in the Pali Canon, characterising the path in these terms. And then he decides to tell them about his own search, his own quest, his own journey. And it's sort of presented in very sort of almost quite clunky, formulaic way. I was subject to birth and so on and so forth, and I looked for what was also subject to birth, and then I thought, supposing I seek the unborn, etc. I suspect it wouldn't have been like that. I've got to be a bit careful, but you know, when you look at the Buddha's life story, and of course we're receiving these oral, different oral traditions about the Buddha's life, and they come down to us in quite formulaic, even stereotypical terms. They're not like life stories that we have nowadays, which are much more sort of complex and nuanced, and you know, psychology is very much to the fore. What we have to do is to imagine a man, and we know that he was brought up within sort of some sort of aristocratic background, kshatriya, warrior caste, warrior community. Some accounts say that he was going to be destined for kingship and so on. Might not have been so grand as that, but certainly a sort of leader's, you know, family of one kind or another, of a small kingdom of some kind in northern India, the borders with Nepal. And but clearly, you know, very early on when you read the accounts, there's this sense that home life is really stifling. There's a wonderful short sutta from an old collection called the Sutta Nipata, which is like a sort of ballad almost, a kind of song about the Buddha's going forth. And he uses this expression, cramped is this life at home, dusty indeed its sphere. Or the life at home gathers dust. And there's this sense of being cramped, of being, you know, really constrained and held in. I think the dust is sometimes explained as defilement, but I just think of it as habits. You know, families, especially, you can imagine the extended family, the Indian extended family, can just be incredibly stifling, especially from a high up, so-called caste. Very, very sort of stifling, very strong sense that this is your destiny, this is what you have to do, this is the way you're destined to live, to inherit the leadership of the tribe. Something very, very tight and those sense of being able to sort of open up. So he said, cramped is this life at home in this particular song. Dusty indeed its sphere. Life gone forth is wide open. You live out under the open sky. I mean, literally, life gone forth is wide open for a, you know, you would not have a home. The traditional way of living, the holy life, the Dharma life in India, whether you were, you know, whatever persuasion you were, was to do this, to shave your head and beard, discolour your white clothing with some mud. That's what the yellow robe really is. And just go right out, not just from your home, but go across the border, go across the river at the border of your country, and go wandering off in foreign lands to search for the truth. So it's wide open literally, but it's also wide open metaphorically. Because going forth traditionally in India is understood as a genuine renunciation of all of that. Of that, you're becoming not just homeless, not just familyless, you're also becoming casteless. You're becoming, in a way, nobody. In Indian early Pali tradition, they talk about the akinchana, the man of nothing, the man of naught. It's actually a sort of symbol of arhatship, you know, that you're giving everything up, you're going to live on begged food, your only possessions are a robe and bowl. And off you go. There's only now you and the open sky. And the open sky, if you like, could symbolise the openness of the search, the openness of reality. In this account, it's really interesting. You know, you've probably read the very romantic accounts of, you know, leaving his wife and children, the last lingering look before, you know, going out through the city gates, and, you know, gods and goddesses open the gates for him and so on. But this account is incredibly stripped down. And it almost seems, well, there's no mention of a wife. There's no mention of a child, which is very interesting. And as if it's done very openly in relation to his parents. As if they're standing there watching it happening and weeping and wailing at what's happening. I mean, they're you know, not just losing their son, but they're losing, in a way, the future. The future of the clan. As a very, very big things are at stake here. You know, and that's the way you did it. That's the way you did it in India at that time. It isn't got to be a question of trying to do it at home. The forces are too strong. I don't even know whether in the time of when the Buddha went forth, there was even the notion of householders, so-called lay people, having a sort of spiritual life. I mean, the Buddha certainly provided a Dharma life for his lay, so-called lay followers. But I don't know, that doesn't seem to have been on offer in his time. In any case, that desire, that Arya Pariyasana, the force of that search, meant that this is what he was going to do. Complete renunciation, entering into this wide open space and going forth. Searching for the truth. It's very important, I think, that we dwell on the Buddha's going forth. I've been saying recently, I think that the Buddha's going forth, his renunciation, is the great shadow for modern Buddhists, maybe even for traditional Buddhists as well. Shadow in the sense it's not something people like to look at, because we're not going to live like that, because people either don't want to or can't live like that, certainly not in the way he's doing it, or even in a more milder form. I think the whole business of renunciation, going forth, living that wide open life, is very, very challenging, and it involves, we talked a bit about giving up in the first half, giving up, letting go, in a way living out fully the implications of that deep longing for the Dharma. There's also the point that we were making earlier that you know, we have, you know, in many cases responsibilities for other people and so on and so forth. So there isn't, in all conscience, people don't feel that they can, you know, renounce in any sort of, in those responsibilities. They don't want to, in all conscience, because they feel that they have a duty to discharge. Somehow or another, though, we need to meditate on the Buddha's renunciation and see what the implications are for our lives, what they mean for us. It is part of the Dharma. You know, the enlightenment comes out of this radical renunciate life. The fullness of wisdom and compassion comes out of this radical renunciate life. What on earth can it mean for us? Or is it that we just sort of, well, we'll just leave that area, and the Buddha's great, and I'm a Buddhist, and I'm benefiting from this life, and we'll leave that alone. I certainly am quite very tempted to do that, not being a great renunciate myself, being very attached to the things of this world. But my conscience keeps pricking me and saying, well, if you're going to do a study seminar on the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, where it's so glaring, there's the Buddha's going forth, you have to raise it. What does it mean for us with all the complexities of this modern world? Very hard to get away from the world. Very, very hard to even for a little, you know, a very short period of time. Such a regulated, controlled world these days. Very hard to really live genuinely free. Very, very hard to do that. And even the whole notion of freedom is very complicated for us. It's very sort of almost, well, it's very tied up with sort of political arrangements. Whereas the Buddha's freedom is entirely different. That sort of spiritual freedom. thoughts? Responses? No,
Ravira. External liberation and liberation. If I'm possible always to go forth, you know, certainly as a Buddha did, there are conditions perhaps for that. But internally freeing from the things, from the dust and the constriction.
Yeah, yeah.
And like you mentioned, it's often really our habits and those sorts
of things. That's true. It's just so long as we're being honest with ourselves and seeing the external things that we're involved with, in turn, because very often the external things we get involved with are bound up with our habitual, reactive way of going about things. Because, you know, you can say, well, it's all in the mind. Well, hang on a minute, we're not just a mind. We're a body and a speech. We're also social creatures involved with people. So as well as looking at the sort of freedom internally, we also have to sort of look at, well, in what way are the externals of our life actually keeping the habits going? I mean, one of the great things these days, I mean, Billy Varchin mentioned it at the beginning, is this addiction to, and it is an addiction, I think, to being involved with communication devices. I mean, it's amazing these days. I mean, in the old days, I mean, people wouldn't even dream of making a phone call on a retreat. I mean, you just wouldn't. I mean, you know, you'd have to walk a long way to get to a phone box for a start, but it just wasn't in people's consciousness. Nowadays, you know, you have to sort of fight to get people to switch their mobiles off and their handhelds and, you know, whatever these things are called. I'm a total techno idiot, so I don't know how it all works, but very, very hard for people to just put that down and so on. Well, that is a habit. That is a habitual thing of not being able to be with yourself and to be with other people without the constant sort of, you know, sense of connection with you know, particular people far away. I think there's some real issues there to look at. You know, I think Buddhists have got to do a lot of work about how what it means to Buddhists lead a simple Buddhist life in relation to, you know, this massive technological revolution. And, you know, I know quite a few of us, you know, who are very active in you know, our Buddhist Sangha. Of course, we can say, oh, well, I've got to be in touch with all these people because it's Dharma work, it's working for the Sangha. Well, it gets a bit dodgy after a while when, you know, you're checking every single thing, not just emails, but news sites and, you know, all the rest of it. It's a, you know, well dodgy, and you find it difficult to be alone, you know, just for a little bit of time. So I think the point is there is the internal freedom from habits, but what I'm trying to get at is that we need to look as well at the way in which externals are reinforcing those habits and find a way of, and sometimes, of course, it's more complex than that because the externals are mixed. There are things which we're positive and people we're positively involved with, but it's mixed up also with some of our worst habits and so on. So it gets more complicated still. But in relation to this, I mean, one thing that might maybe accrue to this is always to look positively. The Buddha entered this life, if you like, died to his worldly life. I mean, there are Hindu traditions of renunciation where the person going into sannyas, the person who's going into the sadhu life, they conduct their own funeral. Very, very powerful. They sort of burn all their worldly goods, and actually, you know, do all the kind of Hindu death rites on the pyre, and then go forth as if to say, "I have completely died to worldliness, and I am now entering this life of spiritual rebirth." The Buddha didn't do that. He just did it by simply, you know, cutting his hair and beard and discolouring his white robes. But it comes out of the positive. This is really important. He has felt deeply, deeply touched by the call of the beyond. Sometimes the Buddha calls Nirvana just simply the beyond, you know, the other shore. There's something calling. There's some strong response to that in him, in a way that's outgrowing that environment, that stifling environment. And that's what leads to the cutting off of, and the going forth and of you know, from that world and that environment. So that's the point, isn't it? That in Dharma life, it's about intensifying your response to the search for the Dharma and to your own transformation, and then seeing what in your life that is a contradiction to that, even feeling it in a way, even feeling the pain of that, both in terms of behaviours and habits and maybe the things you do, the things you're involved with, really noticing the dissonance and really having it's out of that that you're going to start having, if you like, an equivalent of the Buddha's going forth within the complexities of our life and world now. I think as well, another very important side of this is, I mean, the Buddha is going off alone into this quest. He's searching. He doesn't know quite what he's looking for. He's got to find the path. You know, he's really on his own. So there is this sense of, you know, real individuality, you know, real standing alone. I think, and there's something very powerful and important in that that we need to reflect upon, but I think another aspect of going forth is entering into living for something greater than yourself with others. I think that can actually bring about a sort of renunciation. You're not just thinking in terms of the improvement of yourself in this life. You're thinking in terms of the greater good. I mean, there are accounts of the Buddha's going forth where he contemplates suffering around him in others. And that becomes a real problem for him in terms of what is this life where there is this continual dukkha, this continual suffering. What is the end of this? What is the real answer to this, the deep answer to this? So he's motivated not just by a sort of self-centered search, but by something to do with, you know, to do with humanity at large, if you like, life at large. you know, really trying to find some deep answers to things. You know, perhaps we need to reflect on it that way as well. You know, how can I live a life where I can give myself to something that won't just bring about my own fulfillment of the Aryan quest, but will open things up for others that can be part of bringing about the wider good of the world around me, the people around me. That's another thing. And I think when you have that, I think it can result in life becoming a lot simpler. I think it's another way of looking at renunciation, is looking at a simpler life. Looking for what's essential in life. I mean, when you've got an eye for the essential, the sort of things that you know, the clutter, if you like, starts to drop away. You just don't want that stuff there. It's a waste of time. They're like the toys you played with as a kid, and you don't play with those toys anymore. There's something essential that you found for yourself and others that you want to live for, and that simplifies things. So simplicity comes in. So perhaps in looking at the whole topic of going forth for renunciation, these are the sort of themes. Being touched by something greater, which prompts you to respond. Something greater not just for yourself, but for the benefit of others, and maybe working together with others on that project. And maybe this sense of life becoming more essential, more simple. And so certain things drop away. Perhaps there's some themes there that could be looked at. So any thoughts there? Yeah, Todd.
Could have a positive vision, open is the way, the homeless life is open, wide open, the home life is dusty and dry, but there's obviously things that hold us in the mentality of, for me, it's sort of the idea of security. Even if the world's not really working, I'm scared to leave what security I feel I have. Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about freedom and sort of what holds us back from taking a step, not necessarily away from the world, but away from the mindset of the world.
I think, in talking about this, I think I'm just going to say the same thing. I think that when we're still very attached to certain things, it's very hard to see through them. That you can reflect and reflect and reflect, but your emotions are doing something else. You know, it's almost like you're nattering away with Buddhist talk, but your emotions are just, you know, careering off in another direction. So that's why I think you need to really emphasize the positive. And you need to just keep returning to that. And in a way, just sort of stay with that tension and discomfort, even. And a lot of this gets sort of resolved, I think, in experience. I think if you keep practicing, you keep meditating, you keep practicing the precepts, you keep studying the Dharma, you keep contemplating the life of the Buddha, you know, all the positive images of enlightenment, meeting spiritual friends, I think all that stuff, all that world, Dharma world you enter, it really does seem that then things sort of drop away. It's more like that. You've got a perspective, a higher perspective on those sorts of attachments. I think that really is the only way it works. Sometimes it can be the other way, that you get and the Buddha does talk about this, and we shouldn't rule it out, that you suddenly see the sort of, it's quite an unpleasant experience of almost seeing through you really see the unsatisfactoriness of let's call it your old life or something like that. And there is a sort of sense, oh, I really don't want that. That is really horrible. You know, aesthetically and ethically and on so many levels, you just sort of see the sort of, what's the word? You sort of see the ugliness of it, really. But that only comes because you've got something else. You've got this very, very positive vision. If you haven't got the positive vision, you know, you'll see the ugliness of it for a while, but then that will just flip. But there has to be, I think, that sort of sense of the positive that enables you to see that. Sometimes, especially in Pali texts, they dwell on the ugly quite a lot, and it's not attractive. You can feel yourself reacting sometimes. You think, well, I think this is lovely, actually. You know what I mean? It's sort of, you need that strong vision of the positive in order to see through. But sometimes you can have very, very positive experiences of what they call Nirveda. A Nirveda is, it's very hard to translate, can be translated as disgust. But that could be misunderstood. But it is this sort of sense of this is just like a dance of death. It's going nowhere. It's absolutely going nowhere. It seems so meaningful, so firm. It's going nowhere. I don't want it. I don't want to be part of this. It seems, you know, a very, you know, when you have positive experiences of this, it can be a bit scary. It can be a bit frightening. But it is always coming out of that positive vision. There's an amazing account in Sangharakshita's memoirs, again, when he's a young man, and it was before he'd kind of gone forth. He was at a hill station dance up in Darjeeling with his relations, his uncle who was there in Raj days. It was pre-independence, and he didn't really want to go to the, I mean, Banti at the Sangharakshita dance, I mean, honestly, hill station ball, I mean, you know, at a young age. And he said he just sort of looked at this whole scene, the people dancing, and it just became like an illusion. And he felt overwhelmed by a feeling of sort of, well, he used the word disgust. I don't think for the people, but for this whole very artificial way of life. And he said this dance and gaiety going on, he said it was like the dance of death. I mean, and you could think, crikey, that's a bit misanthropic, you know, that's, what's that like? But it's not that, because he talked about this very authentic life of the hill people. Just the ordinary people up in the hill stations, Tibetans, Nepalese, Indians. And he didn't feel that in relation to them. So it was for a particular mode of living that was just really artificial and empty. And just realising, I don't want that. And not just I don't want it, there's something about it that is really frightening, actually. People living very superficial and empty lives. It's scary. And you don't want to go there. You don't want to end up like that. But as I say, it must come out of a positive vision, that kind of view of things. So concentrate on the positive, I would say. Yeah. Yeah.
Does the Dharmapada verse about false refuges help?
Yeah, well, that's another way. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to talk a bit about that. There is this verse in the Dhammapada, you know, many people out of fear go for refuge to trees and woods and shrines and mountain tops. In reality, these are not a safe refuge. In reality, these are not the best refuge. Going for refuge to these things is not the end of suffering. And then he talks about going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It's interesting that they're not reliable. I mean, he's talking about sort of, you know, sort of Indian religious practice of the time to find security in these places, you know, sacred groves and things like that. Well, they're not actually going to be the answer to your questions. At best, you're going to get a little bit of a break from your, you know, your worries and concerns by giving them over to the God or the spirit or whatever. But they're not actually going to deal with the real issues. Well, you can apply that. People don't usually go to hills and mountains and shrines in this room, I don't think, for a refuge. It's worth looking at the things that you do throughout any given day and in your life generally, which you think are reliable and will make things okay. They will deal with your, you know, your dissatisfaction, your concerns about life, your existential issues. So it's not, is in talking about this, it's not a sort of moral point, although there are moral issues involved. It's existential. The act of searching for a refuge is a sort of basic kind of human activity, looking for that which will satisfy, that you can rely on, that person, that way of life, that thing. This is going to make it okay. This is going to deal with my deep concerns, or even my little concerns. I mean, it's all on the level of, I mean, on day-to-day habits, like, I must have a cup of tea. Well, it's not just to do with you're thirsty. I'm talking autobiographically here. It's not just to do with being thirsty. The tea is a sort of symbol of something, of comfort, you know, reassurance, making everything okay, and all that kind of thing. And of course, it, you know, I like a nice cup of tea and all that sort of thing, but it almost becomes a symbol. What would be interesting is if I couldn't get tea, wouldn't it? What would it sort of reveal? And I don't just mean, you know, coming off caffeine and things like that. I mean something much sort of deeper than that. You know, what are the associations? Sounds a bit banal talking like that, but our whole life, actually, we invest everything we do in our life. It's going to give us security. Our own bodies, being alive, even. And we need to look at that and find what really provides deep and lasting security. When everything starts to get taken away. Everything starts to get taken away. I mean, it's very interesting when you get really ill. You have a serious illness. What do you rely on then? When the body starts to break up. Where do you go? What's actually going to make sense of what's going on, this reality, this truth? You know, that makes you engage with it, not pretend it's not there. Engage with it, but creatively, that you can really, truly rely on. I mean, some years ago I had my first sort of major illness and had to be hospitalised. And I found that a very interesting experience because it was... You know, I could, you know, it wasn't clear what, well, it eventually became clear what was going on, but, you know, there was concerns about something even more serious than what it was. And naturally, there was some degree of anxiety and worry and concern. But I felt immensely grateful to Sangharakshita, for the Dharma, to the Buddha, because it's very interesting being in a hospital ward, because inevitably, one overhears conversations going on, and I was in a ward where there were some guys in, you know, really not a good state at all. And some of the conversations, it was between them and their loved ones, it was almost along the lines of, why is this happening to us? How can this be happening? It was that kind of thing. And I thought, well, at least I know in theory that if you have a body, it gets sick and it dies. I've learned that through Buddhism. This is happening to me. It's not going away at the moment. We don't know what it is. It could be something very serious. This happens when you take a body. And I had a lot of resources in the Dharma to be in relationship to that. Metta Bhavana, mindfulness, devotion to the Buddha, reflection on the Dharma. I mean, it wasn't that I was incredibly serene and peaceful and, oh, it doesn't matter whether I die or not and all the rest of it. No, not that wasn't there. But I had things that I could rely on, and I could rely on them. They kind of worked in that environment. And even some of the guys in the ward were sort of picking up on it. They eventually found out that I was a Buddhist. I didn't really want to talk to anybody, but they found out and they said, "We knew. We knew there was something about you." And, you know, and I said, "Listen, guys, you know, it's not quite like that, but I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, you know, that there's, so refuge, you know, is, you know, when we say these refuges, what can you really rely on when stuff is going to the wall, when everything is falling apart? What do you turn to? You know, what have you sort of internalized of the Dharma? What have you blended into your being that you can really use in relationship to that? Because that's what we have to do. We have to blend the Dharma, bring the Dharma right into us. So when everything is falling apart, we carry on. We carry on practicing. We carry on the noble quest. That's our task.
the example you cited of the discussed with the dance and the presentation example, what's the guidance on the inverse when one actually observes something that warrants attention and engagement, political unfairness or inequality, in the spirit of collective consciousness, so that one actively engages with something new, with something that one does, one believes one can do something positive about, rather than being appalled by something negative.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very good point. That's the other side. Yes, compassionate activity, meta activity, engagement positively to, alleviate the suffering in the world is the other side of this renunciation aspect. And obviously, but then you've got this notion of skillful means, which the Mahayana talk about. What's the best thing you can possibly do? Because there's no end to the suffering of the world. There are so many things that need attention. So given one's particular capabilities, one's vocation, if you like, one's feelings, what's the best way to act? Which bit of suffering, if you like, are you going to work to alleviate? Because if you don't think like that, you can be overwhelmed into inactivity. And one argument is that if you genuinely renounce, and renunciation in the end results in, the complete abandonment of any self-interest, then you've got genuine compassion, where you can see, really objectively, as it were, the best way to act, the best thing that you and others can do to work to alleviate the suffering of others. Of course, when you're actually presented with something and someone in real need, you respond immediately. You don't give a lecture on, compassion or the best way to act when somebody is, on the ground in front of you needing immediate attention. You act. Yeah. But this is something that's gone into quite a bit in some later Buddhist traditions. They talk about a sort of Tsongkhapa, great Tibetan master, Gelug master, great masters of Buddhism generally. He had a whole notion of what he calls the three principles of the path, the three principles of the Dharma life that need to be kept in sort of balance. You need this renunciation, this sense of abandoning all sort of self-centered involvement in the world, moving in the direction of nirvana. But that's not enough. You've also got to develop compassion for others. But that compassion has to come out of that, genuine lack of self-interest. But then you also need wisdom to see really clearly into the nature of things so that you can really act as skillfully as possible. He said these three need to be kept in balance in your Dharma life. And I think it's a really profound insight into things. I mean, it's there in the Buddha's teaching, but Tsongkhapa really articulates it very, very succinctly. Because sometimes you can have people that have a genuine response to the world, for sure, they are genuinely compassionate, and they work and work and work, and they burn out, or they get very cynical. Well, that's no good. It doesn't matter what you do. If you're ending up like that, that is not a good place to be. Where's the compassion for yourself? You're a living being too, and so on. So we need to, we do need to be active in doing what we can for the world, but we've also got to do it on, really purifying our motive as much as we can. Yeah. And I think that's where having projects where you're working with others, especially if they share Buddhist values and ideals, I think you've got more of a chance of bringing, really doing some lasting good in the world. I think also it brings up the whole question, this will come up a bit later, actually, when we look at the Buddha's enlightenment itself. It's like, well, what? There are many different kinds of dukkha, there are many different kinds of suffering. I mean, there are very obvious sufferings that we need attention. But there is a dukkha, a suffering, which doesn't get very much attention. It's existential. existential casualties, if you like. I remember Sangharakshita was once interviewed by, when we were building the LBC, converting that old fire station in the East End, and some Methodist ministers were very interested in what was going on, because it was the East End, it was very run down, a lot of young people involved, so they wanted to know what was going on with Sangharakshita and these young Buddhists. And they made the point, you know, legitimately, said, well, you don't seem to be doing very much for the casualties in society, you know, feeding the hungry, you know, housing the homeless, you know, all these things. And Sangharakshita said, well, yes, that's true, we're a very young, small, poor, you know, movement. We're still in our very early days of establishing the Dharma. But he said, you know, there is another kind of casualty in society, and that's the existential casualty. And that's who we're concentrating on. People who long for a Dharma life. People who long to get to the truth. That is a very real suffering, actually. Totally addressed. You know, we tend to focus on the injustices in society and so on and so forth. But what about that deep existential sort of, pain because you haven't got a path? You're not in touch with the truth. And how much does that actually create that dukkha? How much does that actually create a lot of the problems in our society, in our world? The Buddha would say, because people don't live from that deep, you know, truth, if you like, that deep longing for the Arya Pariyasana, the Noble Quest, that's why there is so much conflict, injustice, and so on. He would say quite clearly, because men act out of self-interest, greed, hatred, delusion, you know, the will to power and all the rest of it, because they're ignorant and unenlightened, that's why the world is in such a mess. So he would argue, go to the root to get at it. But that doesn't mean, either, that you become indifferent to the very obvious sufferings around you. When we first went to India, I was with the order member who really got things going in India, Lokamitra, working with Dalits, in particularly in Maharashtra and Gujarat. Now our movement spread over a lot of India. You know, we were working with Buddhists who'd you know, converted from, you know, being, you know, from Hinduism because of untouchability, as it was called years ago. One of the things we were very aware of, they were loving the fact that we were teaching the Dharma. They really were pleased to have very clear teaching, because they felt that since Sangharakshita left India, you know, there really hadn't been much Dharma teaching for them that was of real, you know, was really effective. But we couldn't help but notice, you know, so many, well, not just Dalits, but not just Buddhists, but so many people in very, very obvious suffering. You know, very, very basic suffering. And that prompted the start of the Karuna Trust, that is a charity based in North London, to, you know, really fund different kinds of social and medical and educational projects, you know, in India. You know, you couldn't ignore that. That needed to be part of, you know, our whole practice out there. But it did start with a strong emphasis on the Dharma, living the Dharma life. Maybe we'll stop there, unless there's any further questions.
I was just thinking about this question of kind of going forward from security. I think about my experience of when you're kind of thinking about security, you can, from that frame of mind, you're thinking about yourself as you are with these sort of things that you're holding on to, without these things, you know, so just ordinary you kind of letting go of these things, but actually taking a step on the noble path, kind of you change as well. So you find your courage in taking a sort of courageous step, and from that point of view, actually the issues of security aren't necessarily there or aren't the same.
Yeah, that's very good. You get a quite different perspective on your life, don't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one thing that is good to do is to test yourself from time to time. It's good to test your practice. I mean, maybe some of you feel just coming on this weekend with all these blokes in the marshes of Norfolk is a major test of your practice, of your Dharma life. And maybe you've stepped beyond the known into something a bit more unknown, and it's sort of, you're having to sort of look more deeply at the way you live your life, the way you practice the Dharma. Well, that's a kind of going forth moment. There's a bit of renunciation in that, going into a quite different environment, a different space. Retreats are like that. You know, when you go into a retreat, you're changing the environment to look more deeply at what you usually rely on. And, of course, there can be wonderful surprises, because there might be a bit of fear in there. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because the other side of that is sort of exhilaration of going into the unknown. That's exciting when you don't quite know what's going on. Can be scary. Can also be incredibly exciting. Hey, I don't know what's happening. This is fantastic. Let's enjoy that. You know, try and think of situations. Do you remember when you first rode a bike? You know, I remember learning how to balance, and the bike was a bit too big for me, and it was fantastic for a while. I was going for it, and then suddenly realised I couldn't stop. And then I started to get really frightened. But the initial feeling was sort of exhilaration. Not sure what the point of that story is, but anyway. Whoops. So it's worth testing yourself. I mean, going and living in another country, it's a wonderful test for your how much you've let go of things. And when I first went to India, I mean, it was like a death. This is in the 70s. I mean, India totally freaked me out completely. It was like, you know, all of the madness of my unconscious was just on the streets. Total culture shock. You know, everything just hit me very, very hard. And but out of that, there came something much deeper started to emerge as well. And there was an exhilaration that went with that, with, well, the discovery of new things in myself, and, well, the discovery of making completely new, you know, friends, you know, people with an entirely different cultural background to myself, who, you know, really living it, really living the Dharma life. And that I still have those friendships, they go on. So going and really immersing in another country, I think, really shows you, it shows how complacent you can be, how what you think is all your own independent qualities are incredibly supported by the arrangements of the particular world in which you live. Solitary retreats, they can be really terrific. I mean, don't going for a week at first, or some people can even just manage a couple of days, but being on your own, you know, can be really challenging. I still find them very challenging, because, you know, all the, you know, I'm just not plugged in anymore. You know what I mean? It's like all the plugs have been pulled. I'm sort of, you know, where am I? I'm just with all my stuff. But then the other side of that is you discover the wonderful depths and freedoms just being with yourself. You know, not having to do anybody else's bidding. So it's worth testing yourself. Maybe that's something to think a bit about. What environments could you go into to sort of show you where you are, if you like, which would be a little going forth in that moment, for that time, something like that. Anyway, let's finish there for now. So there are groups this afternoon at 4 o'clock. The groups are all up on the board, and the venues, and who your group leaders are. So do give all this material a really good shaking. Have a really good Dhamma Katha session. Really talk the Dhamma very honestly and openly. And tomorrow we'll carry on with the Buddha's Noble Quest. Hear more about that. Just about tonight, I said last night that we'll start outside, but the weather forecast isn't very good, so we'll all come in here to begin with, I think, and we'll have all the chanting in here. But it would be very nice if the shrine keepers could illuminate the stupa a little bit, so that we can just, you know, it just looks so pretty, you know, coming into the stupa courtyard with that all lit up. Okay, that's enough for today.